Iku Iluna, please rise. Ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki eke hano hano ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now reconvened. E noho I lalo, please be seated.
All right, please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-0000536, State of Hawaii. Respondent, Plaintiff Appellee versus Weiser Walter, Petitioner, Defendant Appellant. Arguing for the petitioner, Dwight Lum. Arguing for the respondent, Stephen Tsushima, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. We're gonna be broadcasting our proceeding today live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. Counselor, are you both ready to proceed? Mr. Lum?
Yes,
Mr. Tsushima? Okay, we have 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Lum, we're going to give you a warning with 20 minutes into your argument so you can save some time for rebuttal. Mr. Tsushima will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Mr. Lum, please proceed.
The way I'll be proceeding, Your Honors, is first I'll go into, I guess, the first issue regarding the denial of Mr. Walter's public defender's motion for withdrawal and substitution of counsel, mostly based on State versus Harter. Then I will be going into motion for withdrawal of his guilty plea, which was pretty much based on fair and just reasons as set forth in State versus Pedro. And my third area I'll be going into was the denial of the motion for disqualification of judge. Okay. First of all, on the motion for withdrawal and substitution, it has to be kept in mind that Mr. Walter, you know, he was 29 years old. This was pretty much his first experience with the criminal justice system. And I guess throughout most of it, he was depending on his attorneys. He trusted in his first public defender. And then he didn't create much of a fuss when they told him that he would be getting the second one, Mr. Aquino. Okay, but throughout all this, from the beginning, he was asserting that, you know, he lacked penal responsibility because he stated that he had been hearing these voices from either God or from demons that he had to, I guess, kill, his the persons with him, his nigh aunt and his nigh nephew, but he denied that this was caused by intoxication. He said he had been hearing voices for a while. I know that, I guess, there was some dispute, I guess, from the experts, but this was his position, that it was a lack of penal responsibility, okay? Then when, Ms. Blinden was appointed in 2016, in October, and it took her a while to actually have an attorney, or never actually found an expert witness, because you
Mr.
were talking
Lum,
about penal responsibility.
Do we really need to focus on the motion, the failure to grant the motion to withdraw at this point, since substitute counsel did enter? Isn't the real issue the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, not a motion to substitute counsel?
I would say it kind of ties in, because one of the things that we talked about, well, in the argument regarding the motion to withdraw the plea was the, I guess, facts and totality of circumstances surrounding that decision. Okay, so it's like he was before the court and he wants to get a new attorney because they were not following through and getting the expert.
I see, they're arguing the reasons for the motion.
And then it's denied, and so, then it's like, as he said it in his testimony, he felt he was stuck with this attorney. Okay, so this is, I guess I'm kind of going the long way about it, but this was the background why he was going before the court and finally agreeing.
Is this,
he
you know,
did not? Oh, yes.
I was gonna ask, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, on Harter, say there's not a penetrating and comprehensive inquiry or colloquy. And there wasn't here. I mean, I don't see a penetrating and comprehensive examination to ferret out irreconcilable differences or conflicts or anything like that. But what is really the remedy when this doesn't happen, when you later have a knowing, intelligent, voluntary plea of guilty?
Well,
and it's sort of similar to what Justin McKenna just asked, too.
Okay. Well, what we're saying, it could not have been a knowing, voluntary plea if he felt that he was pressured into it and that he had no real option. That was Mr. Walter's position when he accepted it. But I guess in terms of the harder inquiry, kind of looking at what would the remedy be, we believe that the proper remedy would be to put him back at square one so he could, assert his constitutional right to a trial, to have witnesses, subpoena witnesses, and present a complete defense, because he never got the chance to.
You're almost suggesting then that it's like a Harder is a Rule 35. You know, if we don't do a harder, then you automatically get a withdrawal of plea. Is it really that, or is it more that the lack of a harder inquiry sort of sheds light on the totality of the circumstances on the Rule 35 motion?
I guess I'm looking in hindsight, because he did actually get a new attorney that would say that it does tie in with the, Rule 35 type motion. But the reason why I think harder is important to get into is, it's not just for, withdrawing or getting a new attorney. The reason for that comprehensive inquiry is to discover the basis for it, because you're talking about discover if there's a lack of trust or reasons for lack of discretion, why they couldn't cooperate with each other. As I said, because he had been thinking that they would be getting him some kind of expert, such as a mental health expert, psychiatrist, or psychologist to evaluate him, and that was never done. Perhaps if that had been brought out, because, like I said, there was no real inquiry, if it had been brought out in a timely fashion at that motion, it could have been raised, and the attorney could have answered the court or answered Mr. Walter as to why they never actually contacted, because
How does the lack of a harder inquiry factor into the Pedro 5 factor test? Okay. Which factor would that fall under, if at all?
Okay, we believe, it's under the more general rubric of the, the background and circumstances surrounding the plea, because we're saying that if you look at it, it's not just what happened on the date of the change of plea or what questions were presented. We're saying that you have to look at, as I said, totality of circumstances, what came before, what led him to that stage of proceedings where he was willing to enter into the plea agreement.
The ICA and its SDO says that at the change of plea hearing, your client specifically said he was satisfied with the help that he had received by Mr. Aquino. So how does that, that's accurate, correct?
Well, that was the questioning that was presented. And at the hearing on the motion withdrawal, he stated, that he just felt hopeless, and also that he figured that, I think one of his statements was, he didn't think it would make any difference what he said to the court at that time. And as we said, we tie it in with his feelings of confusion, hopelessness, and depression after the motion for that withdrawal was denied by the court. And we'll point out, I said there was no real inquiry, so he never had the chance to explain why he thought he should have a new attorney. So it would say it backs up what he's saying, that he didn't think it would make any difference to the court what he said at the time of the change of plea. I'll kind of move forward to the Pedro factors. So we're not just saying that, just that fact alone is enough to withdraw. We're saying that there are other things that his attorneys did not get into with him, which would justify a fair and just reason for the withdrawal, such as failure to tell him about the possibility of a commutation after 20 years after under 7665. You know, it's not guaranteed, but when you're looking at, when you're a young man and you're looking at the chance of getting sent to jail for, say, the rest of your life, because this is the most serious crime in murder in first degree, and no chance at parole, okay, and then, but if you are also given chance, okay, if I can present these facts about what actually happened, about my, I guess, hearing these voices and everything, I could get a commutation in 20 years. So he was not given that information, and we believe that would have influenced him.
I mean, does that logically lead to the notion that during a plea colloquy, the court should be explaining, hey, look, you're looking at, you know, life with the possibility of parole, but hey, you know what, the governor can commute your sentence. I mean, are you suggesting that that's something the court should do as well?
Well, it might be better looking into, but we think that it's something that his attorney should have gone into, because during their questioning on the motion to withdraw, you know, they're asked, you know, what you told him, and they said, you know, they gave him the choices of life without parole or getting into a plea agreement where he have chance at life with parole. They had every opportunity to kind of qualify or add details, but we also, you know, I also told him about an option under 706-665, but they never did. So it appears that they kind of put it in, okay, you either take this or you're going to go to jail for the rest of your life without a chance of ever seeing the light of day.
Mr. Lum, what does the record reflect about why Mr. Walter lost confidence in his attorneys, Ms. Glendon, and then I guess Mr. Aquino? What happened that caused him to think they weren't doing a good job for him, and that apparently, I believe the record suggests, his family was actively trying to get him substitute counsel at the time that he entered his plea? So what are those circumstances?
Okay. Well, I guess at the hearing, he stated that, you know, he had lost confidence in Mr. Aquino because Mr. Aquino, all that time, as I said, they told him that they would be getting him an examiner, either a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And then Mr. Aquino told him that they were not going to get him one. I know in his declaration, Mr. Aquino says that this was discussed with Mr. Walter, but we don't believe that. You know, Mr. Walter, as I said, he agreed with his attorneys. He, like I said, he had faith in them. So if they're telling these things, okay, he accepted them. But finally, you know, he said, okay, something's wrong, okay, because he's not an attorney, but he is saying to himself, it's been like over 2 years, and I still haven't had an independent examiner come and see me. So that was the main focus or reason or impetus for him asking for that, because he thought with a new attorney, he would be able to actually get that done. Okay, one of the, I guess, matters that was discussed on the cross-examination of Ms. Glendon was, you know, not just her failure to, I guess, find an expert, but also in, I guess, trying to find another type, because she did not actually find a psychiatrist or psychologist. She spoke to a pharmacist, I think, from Hilo. But, okay, she said she wasn't sure about, I guess, what they said in the toxicology reports about, I believe, I want to get this straight, okay, about the chlorpheromine, right, and also the dextromethorphan. Okay, and that was discussed in Sharon Teza's report, indicating that, you know, even without the dextromethorphan being present in the tox screen, that the chlorpheromine would indicate that it might be, that it was I don't know if you'd call it a precursor, but it indicated that it was in his system. Okay,
Mr.
but
Long,
she never...
Oh. Would you mind just bringing your microphone down just a little bit more so it's capturing a little bit more of your voice?
What she did not do was contact a, I guess, forensic toxicologist, okay? And because one of the things, as I said, when they brought up the new information about the dextromethorphan was how long had it been in the system, you know, could it have been, you know, from several days before.
You know, what I wasn't clear on, if I may ask you, is what was it just that the public defender did make every effort to find the appropriate expert but just couldn't find one, or was it lack of effort? I wasn't real clear on what happened there?
Well, the court said that the circuit court said that the defense counsel made, I guess, efforts, but it seems, you know, I know it's bad to be doing it in hindsight and what they call second guessing, but as I said, she had 2 years, and she only, I guess, one of those she consulted, I think, was in a Turnbull, and it was like almost a year later when she, I guess, decided that she couldn't get him and was going to look for another source. Would submit, you know, being diligent, you know, you leave him, and he never contacted her. It's like, you leave a message for your proposed expert, maybe you give them a week or two to respond. If they don't, you go to the next on the list, because it's not like, you know, he was the only, I guess, what you call examiner in the state.
Can I ask you, before the public defender agreed to have the state's experts examine the client, was the attorney in possession of the OCCC medical records that had the information about the cough medicine or whatever it was that came up?
Well, that was, I think there was just one indication that she would have gotten that there was discussion of his, saying that he was drunk, but there was no indication, I don't believe so, in, I guess, the closing police report itself saying that.
I'm asking about the OCCC medical records. I thought that's where the reference was to the medication or whatever it was.
This was, well, those were the ones that were done by the OCCC, I guess, psychiatric workers. And, well, she was never really questioned about that, Ms. Clinton.
Did the PD have those records?
Well, we believe.
Before she agreed?
Well, there was not questioned on that, on whether she saw that or not. She only stated that she was blindsided. Another part, well, is that, you know, should she not have looked at that? Because there was, as I said, some in the police reports, you know, they were talking about finding these blister packs in the trash. And so we would say that if, you know, there was that discussion, she should have followed up with what was, you know, because he was taken in to OCCC, I believe, in October 10th or 11th. So they didn't do, I guess, the state's witness examiners until much later. So she did have time. If she wanted to inquiry, she could have. But it appears that, as I said, she was not directly questioned about that when she was giving her testimony.
Mr. Lum, can we go back a step earlier? There were three there was initially a three panel, correct?
Yes.
And the outcome of that three panel, although was sort of back, some of them had multiple opinions and flipped positions. Ultimately, two of them seemed supportive of the defense position and one was neutral. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, because that was also the conclusion. Well, in her scorecard, she said, I guess, two and one, that was a zero. But also, Mr. Aquino, when he took over the case and when he was questioned, he came to the same conclusion, you know, that there were two there that were on the defense's side and one that was, you know, neutral, but it did not hurt them.
Okay, so that at that point, things are looking okay for the defense, it seems. And then the prosecution comes in and says, we'd like two more examiners to examine the defendant. And Ms. Glendon didn't object, except for one. She said, well, I have a record objection to one, but otherwise no objection. And then both of them came back in favor of finding penal responsibility. And I think that was described by Mr. Walters, expert witness, as a disastrous event for the defense. Does that have any role or significance in assessing his state of mind at the time he pled and ultimately as a reason for him being allowed to withdraw?
Yes, Your Honor. A very strong part of the background because, we would say, even though the court characterized it as a strategic decision, we believe it was a big blunder, okay? You know, without going into all the details about being a criminal defense attorney, especially on these Seminole 4 type cases where you talk about penal responsibility, the first, hurdle for the defendant is the preponderance of evidence to get over that first hurdle if you're going to argue the PR defense. But once you do that, then the burden shifts to the state for proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's, I'm going to say, I don't want to say it's fair, but okay, you have a situation where it's two and a neutral, but nothing that's in favor of the state where they say he was responsible, okay? And would argue that, okay, especially if you're the defendant on these PR cases, you have to take attitude, this is as good as it gets, okay? We got it, we got two, we got a neutral, I declared ready for trial, why should I delay it anymore? We just go in, especially since you're talking about going jury waived with the judge, just go in with what you have. I think Mr. Gu characterized it as just a numerical thing. If you got a 2-0, you go for it. Okay, you don't wait. In her discussion, she said,
what would have happened if, in fact, there was an objection? Was there a likelihood that the court would have sustained that objection at that point in the proceedings?
We believe so. Mr. Gu did go into detail, I guess, in her his discussion about State versus NISAM, that NISAM does not stand for the proposition that, you know, you allow the state to bring in their experts. They make a strong point of distinguishing from the EMID type defense where that could be allowed, as opposed to the 704 penal responsibility where they say the requirements are much stricter. And it basically says there's nothing in the statute that would allow the state to bring in its own examiner. And then there is going to also be the self-incrimination part of it where, okay, you're not going to allow them to talk to your client. And if they don't talk to your client, then they cannot testify as to PR or render that opinion. So, as I said, if you take that position...
Can I follow up on that point? So was the defendant required to answer the examiner's questions, and did Ms. Glendon advise him to go ahead and cooperate, or did she tell him, well, they can come examine you, but you shouldn't say a word? What happened?
It looks like, one of the things she testified was, I thought it would be very, very good for the defense to have him questioned by them. And even though on her cross-examination on the motion for his trial, she admitted that, you know, you cannot predict what an examiner is going to do. You don't know what's going to be in the front.
Yeah, you can never predict. I mean, when she's saying that, I mean, obviously you can't predict what anyone's going to say, but she had all the information that she had, and she made a informed decision, which she, the court, well, in her mind, it was a strategic and tactical, because if it came out the other way, it would have been very helpful, right?
Yes, but why took that risk? Because the other part is, I noticed she didn't say that she ever sat down with Mr. Walter and told him, you know, you're risking what we have now is 2-0. You're risking that if we go in and allow the additional two exams. No, what she told him was, you know, I believe it's going to be very helpful for us. So she didn't present any type of downsides to him. It was just, yeah, her belief. And she believed, I guess, based on prior interactions with these, that she would be able to, I guess, get a stronger or whatever opinion on the part of these two new ones. Okay. And we'll point out that, okay, once again, strategic, if you're looking at it as an defense attorney, you ask yourself, why is the state going to the trouble of getting two more experts, okay, when you have two on your side? Why are you thinking, why are they going to do that? You have to think strategically, okay, it's because they think that they have an opening here. Once again, we don't believe that was pure, soundly based decision. We think she was just rolling the dice. She thought she could get away with it, but we think that if you were a competent attorney that was, I guess, looking out for the best interest of a client who, as he said, is facing a serious murder in the first degree charge, you wouldn't take that kind of chance or risk. Okay.
Well, her other option was go get her own expert, right?
Yes, and as we said, she never did really, because Okay, I guess it came out later. I guess there was State versus Avion, which indicated that, you know, not just voluntary, you know, you're not just focused on voluntary intoxication, but you can look at whether, I guess, one of the things they talk about, I guess, methamphetamine psychosis that's influenced by, I guess genes, okay? I think that was one of the things Dr. Blinder was talking about, but there was no attempt to explore that area or any other type of areas by her, because she only went...
Mr. Lum, did the matters that were uncovered from the, I guess it was the OCCC records, the cough suppressant and all that, that the attorney did not know about, is that where the diligence really is? Versus serving up the defendant to two experts, because she could have served up the, like she did, to the two experts, but it seems like those experts who uncovered the cough suppressant in those items, that really tipped their decision. So isn't it really more the lack of diligence on the records?
It could,
or is
be,
it equal or whatever? But it seems like that is a piece to this as well.
Well, it could be, because as I said, the police closing report, as I said, did indicate they found some blister packs in the garbage, and me, that should have, you know, set her off and saying, okay, I gotta look further. As I've said, also the other part we're saying is, you know, she went in October of 2016. He was there a while, and especially, and he was placed on suicide watch, I think, once or twice. But when they're in that kind of situation, you know they're going to talk to or get questioned by psychiatric workers and, I guess, the resident staff psychiatrist. And I said she was never directly questioned on this, but it looks like she never investigated what he might have said or what he might have disclosed in those, you know, interviews or interactions, because, you know, he was in their unit for quite a while. Okay. I would like to kind of get into, I guess, what they said were, I guess, his delays in bringing the motion to withdraw the plea. But as I said, he had been in contact with his family, and he had been, I guess, trying to get a new attorney, because otherwise, why would they have, you know, gotten Mr. Shigatomi hired just 3 days later? But he was making these efforts. But it's just that they could not speak to him because, well, you know, considering he was in custody. But once he knew that Mr. Shigatomi was appointed to him and they met, then his intent was to withdraw the plea and go to trial. So on Mr. Walter's own part, you know, there was no real delay. I mean, Mr. Shigatomi stated that, you know, he had to get transcripts, and there was, I guess, some delays because of the COVID. But Mr. Walter himself did not hesitate or delay in wanting to get the plea withdrawn. Also, looking at, I guess, what you call, I think the court kind of gave Mr. Gu's appraisal kind of short shrift, because Mr. Gu did indicate, you know, well, all his experience, but he was basically telling the court that, okay, if you have that much amount of time with the client and you're telling them, okay, I need to get experts and I need to get this discovery information, then you have to follow through, and that was not done in this case. Okay, now, Mr. Walter, as I said, I'm not here to explain it, but as I said, he did not have a lot of experience with the criminal justice system, so he was basically putting his trust in what his attorneys were gonna do for him. Uh, And it looks like Ms. Glendon, when she spoke to the pharmacist, she did make some kind of inquiry if there was a chance to do some kind of reverse engineering to discover about the dextromorphan levels. But as I said, she was talking to a pharmacist. She did not follow through by trying to get a forensic toxicologist who could do a more precise study. Another part of the, I guess, discussion regarding the, I kind of go back to the withdrawal, the attempt to withdraw as counsel was that, okay, if he had been able to explain to the court the reason, maybe he could have gotten an expert in a timely fashion who could have gone over this. As I said, there was the Abion case that came out, and that might have been explored or discussed or finding some along those lines. But because the court never did that full comprehensive inquiry, a chance for that was not done. I don't know how much time I have left for
rebuttal. About 30 seconds, so okay. I'll give you a little more time if you need it, but perhaps at this point, would you like to wrap up?
I'll kind of go into the third one. I know the court is kind of does not consider this the main point, but we did file the motion to disqualify because just based on an outsider's point of view, we think that there would have been questions as to impartiality of the judge, considering, relationship and having that party planned by the defense attorney, because it's not about questioning credibility of evidence, but whether she believed this attorney was credible about what she did on behalf of Mr. Walter. Okay.
Very well. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Lum. Mr. Tsushima.
For the record, and may it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima, on behalf of the state of Hawaii, good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. Good afternoon to you as well. I did want to inform the court from the get-go that last week I was essentially bedridden with a cold. It was nasty, body aches, cough, fatigue. So I did test for COVID personally and tested negative, but I am able to make it here, but there is still some leftover congestion that you might be able to hear in my voice. I'm gonna try to do what I can, but yeah, I'm here.
Well, if it becomes an issue, let us know during the course of your argument. Thank you for telling us.
Thanks.
And thank you for coming today.
Thanks, Chief Justice. In any event, even before I got sick, I wasn't planning on having a large presentation for this court on these issues before the court. What I was already preparing to do is just address whatever concerns this court had. From the front half, from the get-go, I noticed there's a discussion led by Chief Justice's questions about the three panel in this case, and I'm the last person who's going to say that, you know, I've got it right and somebody else has it wrong. But I thought when it came to Dr. Blinder and Dr. Licton that both of them actually have flip-flopped from their original opinions.
Yeah, I think I mentioned that in my question to Mr. Lum. So they had flip-flopped.
Right.
They had come down ultimately for no responsibility, and the third examiner couldn't really reach a determination. So there was definitely impeachment to be done there.
Right. I guess the only reason why I wanted to bring it up was I heard it characterized as like a 2-0 in favor of the defense. Respectfully, I would disagree. Given what you just said, maybe I don't need to rehash it then. Sounds like this court does have a grasp of what happened in the supplemental reports by both Dr. Blinder and Licton, where they kind of both went in different directions given their findings of, I believe, defendants' use of the over-the-counter prescription drugs and how it affected their opinion. On the one hand, Dr. Blinder found that that led him to his conclusion that there is no mental defense. And Dr. Licton, on the other hand, did, in his March 2018 addendum, find that he believed defendant appeared to lack penal responsibility And then he didn't really touch upon how the over-the-counter drugs would affect his opinion. He just kind of left that alone. But as Chief Justice already pointed out, those flip-flopping of opinions, of course, lent itself to attack by either party. And I believe that's what led to Ms. Glendon's decision on that this wouldn't be sufficient for the defenses to meet its burden. And that's why she did want to move forward with further expert opinion. As I had stated before, there's nothing in particular that I wanted to touch upon. That was the one clarification I did want to make. If there's specific things this court wanted to ask.
Well, what about the notion that wholly apart from whether it was professionally reasonable or not, the fact that she consented to have these two examiners talk to him, at that point, they both came out in favor of penal responsibility, and whatever hope he might have had that he had a case before that went away. And that, I think, was his position, is that was part of why he lost confidence in his attorneys. That's why he wanted to withdraw his plea, and the court never conducted a colloquy with him when he moved to withdraw his plea. So why is that a factor we can consider or should consider in the Pedro analysis?
Sure, because I think that does actually go to his overriding explanation of why he felt that he wasn't given a fair shake here. So, I would say it does go to that, I guess, everything that occurred in his case that led to his dissatisfaction with his attorney. As Justice Edens had pointed out, though, when we're looking at least for the portion of, because I feel like everything needs to be looked at globally when you're looking at the motion to withdraw plea. And when you look at that moment of when he wanted a new attorney, when you look at that and you say, okay, the court didn't do a full colloquy, didn't actually speak to him from what I recall, that is problematic because now we don't know, because there's nothing on the record, what would have happened. We know counsel, PD, was aware that his family was looking to hire an attorney, but we don't know all the surrounding circumstances around that, their ability to hire one, whether they had already contacted one. It's just, you know, I'm not going to make any assumptions myself because we don't know. We just know at that point his attorney was aware that the family was looking for one. But yeah, certainly that does factor in. And of course, the other five factors to consider the surrounding circumstances does factor in. So I do acknowledge and I realize that's what makes this a difficult case because, the court, when making that decision, wasn't aware that of the potential, at least, of hiring a private attorney and how that would have factored in, I guess we won't know.
What about the fact that within 3 days of the plea, Mr. Shigatomi appeared on his behalf? Doesn't that tend to corroborate the notion that there really was something meaningful or a meaningful lack of confidence as opposed to him just going back to OCCC and having second thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and again, yeah, we don't know exactly what the surrounding circumstances were for that, but that seems to indicate he and or the family knew there was that possibility to hire a private attorney because they, in fact, did get him a new counsel and within days of changing the plea, had that attorney hired. But again, what this court would look at is all the surrounding circumstances, including the responses he gave when he changed his plea. I understand from his perspective, he'll be saying, you know, I was kind of going through the motions to get through the change of plea because that's what I had to do. I'm sure that would be his position. But at the same time, you know, when you're giving a complete colloquy like that, making sure, you know, is this what you want? Are you happy with your counsel's representation of you? You know, I would ask this court to give that some weight because he did answer those questions in the affirmative.
I was going to ask you, because since you're talking about colloquy, is, you know, before the motion was resolved, the Rule 35 motion was resolved, this court came out with Glenn. And Glenn was the case where if there's, you know, indications of, you know, lack of penal responsibility on the record, that during the colloquy, the court should, you know, alert the defendant to, you know, issues about penal responsibility. And that case did come out before the court ruled on the withdrawal. Is that part sort of the circumstances on whether the plea was voluntary or not, the fact that the court did not ask Mr. Walter about issues with respect to penal responsibility?
Perhaps I'm remembering the record wrong, but I thought at the change of plea the court did ask some questions with respect to that. Am I correct?
I don't know. Possibly. Actually, I just presume that that didn't happen since Glenn came out post plea.
Right. That's my recollection. I thought that when the court went over the colloquy and the change of plea, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, if they have the transcript in front of them. But I thought the court did say one of the things you are giving up, of course, is the penal responsibility issue or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
I thought that was addressed by the court.
Counsel, can I ask you, I want to make sure I understood what you said earlier, going back to the three examiners.
Sure.
In your mind, it made sense for the defense counsel to agree to the additional exams? Is that your position?
Yes, not so much from my mind, but I'm going off what Ms. Glendon testified to. I believe when she was called to testify, she explained that there were questions in her mind as to all three of them. And she I believe, even gave the reasons why of the flip-flopping of opinions and how that could be, in her mind, easily attacked, and that wasn't going to be sufficient.
Wouldn't it have made even more sense if she got her own expert? I mean, at some point, it seems that she thought getting her own expert was important enough to tell the client that. The client was waiting for that.
Right. I would think so, but I believe what she also testified to is the reason she agreed to those examiners is she believed they were going to be in their favor from her experience. She had experience with those other two examiners, Jacobs and Tizza, and she believed they were going to be favorable for the defense.
Let me ask you a follow-up that was asked earlier of your opposing counsel about those OCCC records. Just so I'm clear from the record, as far as you understand, were those OCCC records available to the initial three panel?
I don't know if they were initially available to the three panel. Let me just check my notes real quickly.
They made a difference to the subsequent two state experts.
Yes, it was. Dr. Licton, in his February 2018 letter, did refer to the OCCC report and admitting to being drunk on alcohol at the time of the offense.
So clarify again, say again.
At least as to Dr. Licton, in his February 2018 defendants admitting being drunk on alcohol at the
time
of
the offense. So they were available?
At least to Dr. Licton, from what it appears from my notes.
What about prejudice to the government? So he enters his plea, Mr. Shigatomi comes in 3 days later, and the motion to withdraw, I think, was about 4 months after that. What prejudice would have resulted to the government to grant the motion at that point?
As far as, like, actual prejudice, I'm not aware of any specific difficulty in some of the witnesses that have moved away, if I recall correctly. But as far as like actual prejudice of lost witnesses or lost evidence, I'm not aware of any. It has since been like 5 years, 6 years since that has occurred. So I can't say that now the potential for prejudice hasn't affected the prosecution. I don't know one way or the other.
But back then, at that point, was there any specific witness who was lost during those 4 months, someone passed away, anything like that?
I don't believe so, Chief Justice.
you consider that 4-month period undue delay in your mind, given that it was COVID and you got an attorney brand new coming in, they got to get the record, they got to get up to speed. It's a extremely serious case. 4 months seems undue.
I don't know if unduly. I was just curious. I believe when I wrote my brief, like there just didn't seem to be an explanation for it. I'm sure they're doing their research. I'm sure there's things they're looking into. I think they made reference to wanting to hire an expert attorney, expert witness as to whether he was even mentally able to do his change of plea. So I'm sure they were doing things with the defense. I was just curious because it seemed like them probably was on the forefront of their minds at the time. And it was just curious that when it came time for sentencing, they seemed to present this reason why the sentencing couldn't happen that day. And I'm sure you've read the record. It seemed like the trial court seemed a little irked, like, why can't they do the sentencing today? And yeah, I won't rehash what happened in that situation, but the sentencing got continued one more time, and then that's when they filed it. So that's the only reason I mentioned it. I didn't understand the delay myself.
Anything else at this point, Mr. Tsushima?
I have nothing further, Chief Justice.
All right, and again, thank you for appearing today.
Right, thank you.
Mr. Lum, a brief rebuttal.
Yeah, considering the briefness of that, I don't think I have too much to go into in the rebuttal. I was going over the February 2020 Chestnut Chain Plea transcript. I didn't have a chance to read the whole thing, but I don't think the court did make any question or mention about giving up that penal responsibility defense or inquiring into it. And I'd like to, discuss about that discovery, because discovery from the, OCCC records would have been available. You know, part of the statute is that if the examiners had asked for it, it would have been provided to him. But it appears that I think Licton was the only one who kind of took a look at it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lum, can you speak?
Oh, sorry. So it looked that based on the, records, because the examiners, the initial three would have had provided access. But it looks from their letters that I think Licton, I think, was the only one that actually looked at it or asked for copies. I'll point out that, when you're looking at Tarter, we have, not Tarter, but Pedro, they're the two different approaches. So even if the court looks just at the change of plea colloquy, and finds that there was a knowing involuntary given, you still have to look at the second part, the five-factor Pedro test, and we think that under the totality of circumstances that Mr. Walter, he himself, as I said, was going for asserting he was penally responsible from the very start. So we'll be asking for him to be given the opportunity to go back and assert his constitutional rights to get a trial and present all his defenses. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much to both our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'opu ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki ike hanahano okumoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.